This is the wartime broadcasting service. This country has been attacked with nuclear weapons. Communications have been severely disrupted, and the number of casualties and the extent of the damage are not yet known. We shall bring you further information as soon as possible. Meanwhile, stay tuned to this wavelength. Stay calm and stay in your own house.
Why does the sun rise every morning? What's the air I'm breathing? Because we're smart and we're asking those kind of questions, it's very natural to also say, and what if it stopped?
They're thinking about it coming to an end, the whole show being wrapped up.
Whether or not you can actually realistically think about evacuating the population is questionable.
Survivors would literally just slip back into the Middle Ages.
We're really damaging our planet, and we are the ones that are going to pay for the most.
There's a man going around taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame.
We don't know at the moment of any big ones that are definitely going to hit, but we do know that a big one definitely will hit sooner or later. My name's Jay Tate, and I'm the director of the Space Guard Center. The role of the Space Guard Center really is threefold. Firstly, we do act as the National Near Earth Object Information Center. We also aim to educate the general public, schools, universities, and so on matters relating to near-Earth objects and the impact hazard. And finally, we have a tracking program here where we use telescopes to track potentially dangerous near-Earth asteroids. There are a number of asteroids on what's called the NASA risk list. These are ones that have non-zero hit probabilities, i.e. they could hit. The probabilities, though, for those are very, very small. However, you know, you have to remember that if one of these big ones does hit, it's absolutely catastrophic. So even a small hit probability can be a cause for concern. As a general rule of thumb, if you imagine something about the size of a tennis court, 20 to maybe 50 meters across, that wouldn't hit the ground, it would explode in the air before it hit the ground. That would take out an area about the size of a large city. If we up the game to something about 150 meters across, think football stadium size, that would hit the ground, and the damage area there would cover the size of a small country. If we had something about 1 kilometer across, then the effects of that would be global.
It's something that we don't want to think about because there's nothing that we can do about it. Hi, my name is Justin Batten. I am an academic tutor here at the University of Sunderland, also working on a PhD on mobile media technologies and one's being in the world. There's obviously climate change, potential for asteroids coming down and causing great destruction, but at the same time, these threats have always been there as well. Only now, I think, with obviously media texts and the disperse of information, is it becoming much more widespread and discussed on a mass scale, of course. But climate change is one. Nuclear war is another. One of the great ones would be nuclear war, at least one of the most pressing ones. Biochemical warfare as well. Climate change or potential environmental disasters and something from outer space, whether it be an asteroid or hostile extraterrestrial life as well, would be, I guess you could say, three things to be concerned with. Potential of something like viruses as well that we cannot control. As you know now, antibiotics are used quite prevalently, often quite destructively. People take them when they shouldn't be taking them. Just because you have a virus doesn't mean you should be taking antibiotics, but people still do because of various reasons, whether or not it's something to do with capitalism, whether or not it's something to do with one's own fear and not being instructed on when you should take antibiotics. That could be something that is a great concern as well, because obviously if we do not have the drugs to combat a particular virus, then that could cause widespread destruction.
My name is Simon Ross. I'm the Chief Executive of Population Matters. We're a membership organization working for a global population size, providing good standard of living for all and environmental sustainability. Now, we're all aware of humanity's impact on the environment. There are limited resources, and the consequence of ever-rising population is quite serious, because the amount we all consume increases. One consequence is rising resource prices, which affect the poor in particular. Another consequence is erosion of the natural habitat of wildlife and the environment, loss of forests, pollution of waterways, climate change, and so on. And finally, people in the UK will be aware of population pressure on housing, job opportunities, transport infrastructure. So in all sorts of ways, the more people there are, the more problems we are making for ourselves in the future.
My name's Tamsin Gray, and I work as an Antarctic meteorologist at the British Antarctic Survey. It involves research in the changes that are taking place at the minute in the atmosphere, in the Antarctic and in the polar regions, and trying to work out what that means for the rest of the world. So actually I spend a lot of my time on bases in the Antarctic, taking direct measurements of things like the weather, the temperature, for example, and then keeping records of how that's been changing over the past time period. I wouldn't say that any of my findings really are pointing towards the end of the world, but myself and other colleagues here at the British Antarctic Survey have done work that is showing that temperatures in parts of Antarctica are rising quite rapidly at the minute, a lot more rapidly than in other parts of the world, and that's causing ice to melt in Antarctica, which is contributing to global sea level rise. And that's something which is going to have a big impact on the way that we live in Britain. Not necessarily end the world, but change probably the way that we live.
One of the things we particularly say, as many people don't think about it, is smaller families. Some people do, but a lot don't. If there are fewer of us, it makes life so much better in the future. Now, in developing countries, large families are largely due to a lack of family planning. In the UK, sex education in school is not always done well, and family planning is under threat with cuts. And we think we also need to look at things like child benefits. You know, perhaps make that payable for the first two children, but then limit it to those who really need it. But the main thing we want government to do is to talk about it, to talk about the right number in terms of our population size, to say we're big enough and that it's time to stop.
I'm John Davidson, and I'm a chair of Earth Sciences here in the Department of Earth Sciences, University of Durham. I work on the rocks that volcanoes produce and try to figure out, understand how the volcanoes work. I don't think they can cause the end of the world, but volcanoes have certainly caused lots of catastrophes because some of the volumes of volcanic material that have been erupted in volcanic eruptions in the past are massive, and of course populations like Pompeii have been overwhelmed, and Pompeii is a pretty small eruption. So if you think that the biggest eruptions are of the order of thousands of cubic kilometres of material being erupted, it has the capacity to produce climate change, which of course has knock-on effects, along with the immediate vicinity of where the volcano is. Most places where there's a volcano with a potential for erupting have plans in place as to what would be done with the local populations in terms of evacuation. And for medium-sized volcanoes, it's fairly straightforward. You know, you need to get your population moved out of harm's way. You need to worry about food supply, water supply, things like that. Mechanical equipment failure due to the ash that's in the atmosphere. But of course, the bigger the eruption, the more problematic it becomes. And if there was a potential of a big eruption of something like Yellowstone, the question becomes, is it even feasible to think about evacuating large populations? Of course, at Yellowstone, it's fairly remote, but I mean, there are areas like around Naples where there's very dense populations, and a volcanic eruption could have a big effect. And whether or not you can actually realistically think about evacuating the population is questionable. There's plenty of study of the potential environmental hazards and the level of catastrophe that they could potentially afford, and volcanoes being one of them, earthquakes, tsunamis. I mean, we've seen some in the last few years. Meteorite impacts, of course, would be a big one as well, and one that we probably know the least about, and one that you could argue would be potentially the most dangerous if you've got a large meteorite impact.
The likelihood of an asteroid hitting the Earth is 100%. In fact, it happens all the time, but we don't notice it because they're too small. The Earth picks up about 100 tons of stuff from space every day. Most of it's dust, so you don't really notice. But every now and again, a big one comes along, and that's when we have a problem.
This is a Code Red announcement. NASA efforts to avert Meteor 2020 have failed. You're advised to make your way to government safe cellars and await further communications. You are urged to assist any children or vulnerable adults who may need your aid.
The thing that wouldn't survive, though, is the infrastructure that supports a technology-based civilization like ours. That would fail. So survivors would literally just slip back into the Middle Ages and then hopefully over a few decades recover.
A lot of the communications that we do, the TV we watch, the phones that we use, the credit cards that we use, all those transactions are using spacecraft. So we're very reliant on it. And any disruption in that kind of service can come from impacts on spacecraft from solar events. My name's Louise Harrit, and I'm a professor at physics at UCL's Mullard Space Science Laboratory. Well, the explosions happen regularly, and the sun has a cycle of activity, so it will go through periods where not really a lot happens in the sun, and then it will build up again and be very, very active. So it's in that kind of active phase at the minute. And those cycles, those periodicities last between 10 and 13 years, something like that. So we're in a period of more excitement on the sun at the minute. So the more explosions occurring. So it can have a number of different effects. The most of the effects are happening because we've developed so much in technology over the past 50 or so years. So we are actually more reliant on things like spacecraft than we really understand that we are. We're approaching solar activity maximum. And during this time, you expect to have a lot of different flares occur. And there have been flares regularly. There have been some quite big ones this year already. And the effect that it can have is, if it is an Earth-directed event, it can have impact on spacecraft, but it can also have impacts on electricity grids. So what happens is that the storm that occurs in the sun as it approaches the Earth, it's basically a mix of hot plasma and magnetic field. And that magnetic field from the sun will hit the Earth, and it will interact with the Earth's magnetic field and will disrupt that and cause a lot of fluctuations in the Earth's magnetic field. That will build up extra currents, and that can damage transformers and things like that in the electric grids. So yes, these kind of things can happen, and industry has been working hard to try and prevent it and respond to it appropriately if such a thing happens.
There's going to be a crunch point for us all in the next 30 to 40 years. Population is going to expand by about 40%, from 7 billion now to about 10 billion. There'll be increasingly high per capita consumption around the world as globalization and industrialization spreads. Now, that's going to affect the environment, of course, but it also means there are real limits to resources, whether we talk about fish, freshwater reserves, mineral fertilizers, or pressure on fertile land. There will be a rising demand for food and potentially a fall in supply, and that could easily lead to a crisis where there's not enough food for everyone, and I think we all know that that's a huge issue.
I personally don't think we could survive without bees. We owe so much to them, and a world without bees is definitely a world where something has gone awry.
I'm Maryam Hinnain, and I'm an investigative journalist and filmmaker.
They really are indicator species. They're the modern canary in the coal mine, and they are messengers. And so I would not like to think of a world without them.
My name is George Langworthy. I'm a filmmaker and writer, and Maryam and I are the directors of the documentary film Vanishing of the Bees.
I think that for a lot of people, when they think about bees, they think about getting stung. Honeybees are essential. They are essential if you want fruits, if you want vegetables, because they pollinate all of those crops.
Vanishing of the Bees is a documentary concerning the worldwide disappearance of honeybees, and they've been disappearing very mysteriously en masse around the world for many years now. It's a full-length feature that really covers the story from top to bottom because it's a complex issue and involves a lot of factors about many different subjects, for ranging from our agriculture system, the economy, politics, and it's all intertwined in the story of the bee.
A lot of people out there don't realize that one out of every three bites of food they stick in their mouth, these honeybees put on their dinner table.
And without bees taking pollen from one apple tree to another apple tree, you wouldn't get any apples. And we estimate that the value of honeybees is nearly $16 billion in the United States alone.
The aim of making the film was really to raise awareness about the global disappearances of the honeybees and to try to relay to people how important bees are. And then as the years went by, if I look at now what the importance of the film is, it's really to tell people that our food supply is being tainted by chemicals and that we really need to know where our food comes from in order to save our ecosystem and ourselves.
There is a notion that if we all work collectively, then we can change something. I'm not necessarily as sold on that, although I think definitely you can make a case for it. But in the end, are we really going to be able to combat climate change by just telling people to not drive so frequently? Are we going to really be able to combat climate change by moving to more wind farms and whatnot? And obviously, by doing that, I don't think people realize how much we'd have to actually sacrifice in our own day-to-day existence. I think that's one of the rationales why people are so against extremist perspectives is because they don't want to leave behind what they currently have. And when I say what they currently have, I don't necessarily mean possessions, but a routine, a comfort of living the day-to-day life that they have, knowing that it will always be there in the course of the existence as they go.
I don't like it when people are really negative in terms of talking about environmental events, because it gives people the impression that there's nothing we can do about it, you know, like we've already gone past some kind of point of no return. Whereas, in fact, the way we need to look at it is we've predicted what might happen if we do and don't do anything. And there's a huge difference between them. So there's more reason than ever now to do something about the way that we're living so that, you know, the world is going to be in a fit state for future generations of people to carry on enjoying.
My name's John Butterworth. I'm a professor of physics at University College London, and I work on the ATLAS experiment, which is one of the big experiments at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. At the Large Hadron Collider, what we're doing is we're colliding protons together at very, very high energies, the highest energies we've ever managed in a lab. And essentially, we're studying the products, because there's a lot of energy there. You can create a lot of new particles. So I've been involved in analyzing several of the processes of the kinds of particles that are produced there. And in particular, one of the things we've been looking for is this Higgs boson. The whole scare, the kind of nervousness when we switched on was actually driven by a few people who I think had a strange kind of agenda. But the reason it picked up and the reason people were concerned was because physicists say things like, we're doing an experiment and we don't know what's going to happen. Now, with an experiment, you obviously don't know what's going to happen. Otherwise, there'd be no point doing the experiment. But you do know some things are not going to happen. Now, we were talking then, actually, one of the things that we still might see at the Large Hadron Collider, in fact, is evidence for extra space-time dimensions. If that's the case, that means there's a fair chance you might actually create little mini black holes at the Large Hadron Collider. And that sounds a bit scary, that you're making a black hole in the middle of Geneva, isn't it? And black holes, enormous things that eat galaxies, isn't it a bit rash to make one in the middle of Geneva? Now, the theorist's answer to that is that, the same theory that says you might make these black holes tells you that they must immediately decay away, and they're so small they never get the chance to suck anything in at all, really. So that's the theorist's answer. I'm an experimentalist. I would, if the whole of the safety of Geneva and indeed the world rested on some theory like that, I wouldn't want to take the risk myself. they're actually ultra high energy cosmic rays, protons and lead atoms and iron atoms and things, photons, flying around in the universe at these energies already. And if you could destroy a planet or even have any kind of major catastrophic event, really, from these collisions, then we would see stars and planets winking out of existence or exploding around us in the galaxy. And in fact, we would most likely not be here because the Earth would have been destroyed by one of these things long before we'd have got smart enough to build the Large Hadron Collider.
In terms of satellites, what has been done over many years is to try and develop technology that won't react to events on the sun so much. So the technology that has been developed is very good, but you still get impacts on the spacecraft. In terms of aircraft, which is another thing that can be affected, they do have a system where they can inform the pilot that they have to be redirected if a storm's occurring and things like that, so that that's all in place. So those kind of things can be done to help. But obviously, if a super event happens, then there is a risk that all those things that you do won't completely help the situation.
Losing all the pollinators as a result of the poisons, the pesticides used in industrial agriculture, and butterflies, bats, hummingbirds, other native bees, all kinds of insects are dying, and that results in a loss of other species up the food chain, birds, and, you know, basically the destruction of an ecosystem. Our landscape is becoming very toxic, and it's also a threat to humans. There's all sorts of illnesses that are direct result of a toxic environment. We have a massive rise in autism, cancer, allergies, other types of illnesses that are environmental toxin, you know, related. So a lot of people point to the fact that we will lose a lot of our food supply if we are unable to turn this around and create a better situation for the bees, but it's actually much bigger than that. It's jeopardizing our entire ecosystem and the balance of life on the planet. The message of the bees' disappearance is not a message to alert people as to the dangers of bees going extinct. The bee disappearance message is a message for people. It is a very, very important and perilous message, and it's directly linked to the way we produce our food. So it's not really about bees going extinct. It's about people creating a toxic landscape that's poisoning the earth.
We're collecting data that we've been collecting for a long time. So, I mean, it's really important to keep long-term records so that we can notice when things aren't ordinary, like they aren't at the minute. The changes that we're seeing at the minute are a lot more rapid than anything we've seen in the past thousands of years, really. And we're studying some of the glaciers in Antarctica, some of the really big glaciers and ice streams, which is where huge amounts of ice flows towards our oceans. And there are some places in West Antarctica in particular where it's warming up and the glaciers are speeding up, and we think they could be quite unstable, so they could actually contribute quite a lot of water into our seas in quite a short time period. And that's a bit scary because it's a little bit unpredictable, so we could see some quite big sea level rises without too much warning. So we're trying to understand that and predict that at the minute. I mean, if you look at London, for example, with the sea level rise that we're predicting at the minute, we think that by 2100, there'll probably be between half a metre and a metre of sea level rise, which is huge, really. That's a big difference. And even if you don't think that's going to make a difference, if you then look at extreme weather events like flooding, the barriers that are in place at the minute on the Thames are supposed to protect London against something like up to 1 in 1,000 year flooding events, With half a metre of sea level rise, 1 in 1,000 years becomes 1 in 100 years. And with a metre of sea level rise, it becomes 1 in 10 years, which is probably a risk that people living in London think maybe is not worth taking. So, you know, as we see sea level rise, and it's the same with temperature changes and things, it changes the frequency of extreme events really quite dramatically.
The point with risks is, I mean, and in science in general, it's very hard to be absolutely certain about anything. There's always a vanishingly small possibility that something very strange will happen. So to try and eliminate risk completely is just not possible. In the end, they will never be zero. But they can be so small that you can say, well, actually, the risk of not doing the experiment is probably much bigger than the risk of doing it. It's similar to, you know, understanding a new drug or something. You say, well, I want to put a new drug on the market. It might have unfortunate side effects, and we might not know until we've given it to millions of people, because there might be very delayed side effects. On the other hand, millions of people are dying from this disease already, so there's a risk of not doing it, there's a risk of doing it, and you have to use your judgment to make the right decision at the time. With the LHC, that's a whole crazy discussion to have, because the risk is so vanishingly small of turning it on that it might as well be zero. But, you know, as a good scientist, you can never say a risk is absolutely zero. You should say, okay, well, what's the risk of not turning it on? And actually, that could be appreciable, and in this case, it's probably much higher.
One of the big things that we rely on is kind of numerical models. So we simulate what's going to happen in the future. And those models are getting much more realistic. I mean, every time a new report comes out, a new IPCC report on climate change, which come out every 4 or 5 years and produce the kind of latest predictions from all the global science that's gone on about what we can expect in terms of sea level rise and global temperature rise and things like that, those predictions become kind of an order of magnitude better in terms of their accuracy, because things like the rate at which the ice sheets are melting is something that we've really only started to understand in the last 10 or 20 years. And we're getting better and better technology that we can gather that information with, and bigger computers that we can simulate future scenarios all the time. We're never going to be able to stop speculation, because we're never going to be able to say this is definitely what's going to happen in terms of predicting extreme events. Because even if we could do that for ones that we think are caused by climate change, which I don't think we will be able to, I mean, there's still going to be natural events where we can't say whether they're being caused by humans or would have happened regardless of any interfering that we've done with the world. So extreme environmental events are part of the world that we live in. They're always going to be unpredictable. The thing that we're probably doing by putting greenhouse gases and other things into our atmosphere is increasing the frequency and the likelihood of the very worst of those kind of big catastrophes.
The energy field of the universe is there, sort of, and there are theoretical risks that energy field of the universe might not be completely stable, and that at some point there might be some catastrophic event that makes all the atoms in everyone's body fly apart simultaneously and completely wipes out not just the world, but the universe. There's really nothing we can do about that either way, so I wouldn't advocate setting up a parliamentary committee to investigate how we mitigate it. The fear of the end of the world is a very rational fear, and I think it is the fear of the unknown. In fact, maybe more subtly than that, it's the fear of complacency. It's almost the fear of the known. Because we're quite smart human beings, and we get used to a way of behaving and an idea of what's normal. And I think people do have this urge to think, yeah, but what assumptions am I living under? Where does my food come from? Where does my power come from? Why does the sun rise every morning? What's the air I'm breathing? And because we're smart and we're asking those kind of questions, it's very natural to also say, and what if it stops?
We all want to know what the end will be. Our own personal end is something that's mysterious, and I suppose the end of the world, whatever you mean by that, is also rather mysterious. But I think, actually, it depends what you mean by the end of the world.
Because the world, I'm sure, will continue until such time as the sun runs out. Human beings probably have a limited lifespan, because if we look at history, then we can see that most species will eventually die out, and we'll die out too.
We look at images on the television, and when we see the floodings, that we know that the end of the world for some people, you know, it's coming.
I tend to think of my own end more than the end of the world in general. It'll probably go with a whimper rather than a bang.
When the man comes around,
it's fear of being stuck in a box of normality and not thinking beyond it. And there's something in us that always makes us want to think beyond it. And that comes at a price, this fear of the unknown.
Switch your radios off now to save your batteries. That is the end of this broadcast.